You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings.
Hey, everyone.
Well, today's guest institution, FCI Segalville. That's right, FCI Segalville, low-security institution, has a camp and also a detention center there.
Has a little 100-bed jail.
Yep, based in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, about 11, 12, 13 miles south of downtown Dallas. They have RDAP programs and sex offender treatment programs as well. So FCI Segalville, they were our kind of neighbors there for a while. We actually, back in the day in the regional office, I mean back before Grand Prairie, we would have some of the campers and those guys. They were kind of our, they would fill up the tires for the cars and all that. So they were.
So they did were you know road. That way back, it actually was a female facility?
Yes.
Like way back. Before our day.
Yeah, way back. So
it was also used as a Japanese internment facility during World War II.
Internment camp. It was. Gosh.
Past lives of federal prisons.
Very good history there.
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you very much on that. Well, you know, we always had a good, exciting week and everything, and we thought of some. I like the idea that we talk about things that we help get fixed, okay? That we help get things fixed. And so things that would not fix themselves organically, things that would remain unfixed. So I'll let there's classification errors, there's other mix-ups. I'll let you pick the first category of things that we have helped.
You know, and I think it's, before we dump into that, I think it's important to say that, and I say this because I was a case manager and a case management coordinator for a big chunk of my career, is a lot of times the errors that we see that we help get fixed, it's not because anyone's done anything mean or malicious. You know, you have case managers and case management coordinators of varying experience. And depending on the extent of their experience makes a difference in kind of the output of the work. And of course, you know, during the pandemic, there was travel stopped, training stopped. Right. So there wasn't in-person training going on. And previous acting director, Ms. Toomey, actually mentioned during her one and only congressional testimony that they had also suspended travel for training. So, you know, you had whole groups of case managers and case management coordinators and unit managers newly selected that weren't getting to travel for that specialized in-person training. And when you can't do that, you're left to Teams meetings and emails and memos as a method of training. And while there's a place for that, you know, some folks would argue that unless you don't have a structured virtual training program, that in-person training is really important. A lot can get lost on a Zoom meeting, as we all found out during the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I mean, even what my last position was at the term oversight specialist is part of that, of the job. I mean, these things just happen. I mean, bashing anybody or saying anything bad about any, but just there's always going to be things that happen that are either mistakes or there's errors in the system per se, you know.
Right. And we talk about that in the books that we've done, you know, and paying attention and being knowledgeable to monitor your own stuff that's going on. So, yeah, so I thought we would pick on one that's you don't necessarily see happen that frequently. And that has to do with, you know, I've just remembered I didn't turn my phone down, so I want to not have my phone ringing while we're talking, because that would be terribly rude if I could figure out how to do it, because I got a new phone. So we will just hope it doesn't ring. Nobody call me.
Attention on the compound.
Don't call me.
Don't call me.
Don't call me. So we recently had a case with a history of violence item being scored that shouldn't have been. And it was a situation, and this does happen periodically. The individual had both state and federal charges stemming from the same event. And it was a violent offense. And the DSCC scored it, the state conviction, as a history of violence item, which it wasn't. It was part of the instant offense. But that history of violence item for serious violence less than 5 years was 7 points. And that's huge. And that made the difference between being at a medium and being able to go to a low. And once kind of we provided the policy citations regarding the case and a little bit of a timeline with the state and the federal overlap, he was able to go back to his unit team and his case management coordinator and was able to get that resolved. And he is working on moving to a low at this point.
Awesome.
So. And that can be confusing, especially if you look at it and if the state conviction happened first. And so, well, it was before, so it was a prior. But right. The issue when it comes to priors has to do with what we call a break in custody. Something is not a prior if it all happened at the same time, even if it's two different jurisdictions. As a case manager training or case manager coordinator training case managers back in the day, when we all understood with Cubans the wet feet, dry feet policy, right? It's very black and white. Either they've touched ground or they've picked up in the water, right? So wet feet, dry feet. Same thing goes when it comes to prior incarcerations. Either there is a break in custody and you step outside and you're not under anybody's authority, or you're not. And so if you left a state charge and you immediately transferred, like on parole, you're paroled from your state charge, and the marshals pick you up on a federal detainer and transport you to a federal prison, you have never had a break in custody. Therefore, it's not a prior. So, which is important when you think about how we score classification, the instant offense. When you score the instant offense, you take the most serious documented behavior. And if the most serious documented behavior was that consecutive no break in custody state term, then you, let's say you get the 7 points, right? But getting the 7 points on the instant offense versus getting a serious history of violence plus the instant offense, and that, you know, that cumulatively creates more points and moves you up in your security level. So understanding that break in custody, and that is the being released from one term and not being picked up from another jurisdiction. You are a free person, even if it is only for one day.
Right. Makes all the difference.
Yeah. So. And that's unusual. That's not, I mean, it's not the most common situation. So it can be confusing. So that was recent. That was just in the last, couple months?
Yep.
Another area we see related to classification, and recently we've actually had two or three cases that this impacted, is the scoring on GED status.
Okay.
And when you're in bureau custody, you have that interim, I'm sorry, I got a little tickle going on here. You have the option, you get scored either as not having a GED and not participating, participating, or having a GED. So it's 0, 1, or 2 points. When it comes to pre-arrival, you only have the, either you have it or you don't. So it creates a situation by bumping your classification score, your base score, by 2 points, as much as 2 points. And we have had now two or three cases just in the last 6 months where the way the PSR was documented, it did not include a verification that the individual completed either their high school diploma or their general equivalency prior to coming into custody. And like I said, I don't know why we've had, like I said, we've had two or three in the last 6 months.
And that's 2 points? How does that, is that a 2 point? Yep.
Yes.
And so something, right. And you can't take that for granted. I think a lot of people take the education piece for granted. And also, you know, some probation officers actually take the time and verify, you know, but how that's written up and make sure that it's verified. And sometimes those 2 points, man, that's on the line. It gets you from
absolutely
one thing to another.
And the problem is DSCC will not investigate anything. Whatever is in that PSR is considered gospel. And the standard practice is wait till they get to their designated facility and then investigate it. And then in the case of GED, you know, the person will touch base with the education department. They'll have them sign a consent to release information, and the education department will reach out right. to try to get that verified. But if you can get it fixed, and that's something, you know, we talk about in understanding security designation and custody classification, and we really direct it toward attorneys, right, is the importance of making sure that that's taken care of and very clearly stated verified. So
right.
We see a lot recently, particularly for individuals with shorter sentences, where the institution has, you know, they've come in, they've gotten the UTM initial classification, comes back 6 months later, and they're recommending halfway house, and they're doing the halfway house paperwork. In some cases, they're coming back 3 months later, and they're doing a halfway house recommendation if they're really a short sentence, right? And at their initial team, of course, they don't have any FSA information yet. And at that first team, they do, but depending on when the first team happens, they only have one, their initial conditional release date with the 10-day rate. And it's not until they get the 30 days, that 208 days, and then they hit their 30 days, and then the calculator runs, do we right. see that updated date? And so, again, we've had six or eight of clients in the
we
last...
We had a call today. A lady client got a very favorable RRC placement, extremely
rather
favorable.
Rather surprisingly in this climate.
Yeah, and... However, she texted me and said, hey, it looks like I'm going to be here until such and such 26 or whatever. Then you and I discussed it like, no, because you're going to go from 10 to 15 day year. You know what I mean? So that's
well, she didn't even have her conditional. Yeah. The halfway house didn't even have the conditional release date information. They were literally giving her
GCT.
Whatever. GCT with yeah. earned credit and didn't even yeah. have conditional information. Right. So, yeah, we're going to make sure she has that information.
Right. And the halfway house, right. The halfway house has, you know, limited information. They don't.
They're a contractor.
They get whatever the region gives them. Right. They're contractors. They're not BOP employees and stuff like that. So this is yet again, one of those examples for our advocacy and ability to communicate. Should that be the case, you know, we'll communicate with the RRM office and say, hey, here's what's going on, this and that. And then, oh, yeah, but her home confinement is still up in the air because of the geographic miles.
Yeah.
Miles from the facility. Another.
And that's just that lack of female bed space. We just don't have the same.
Yeah.
We don't have the same proximity for female bed space that we right. do with the males because the females represent such a small fraction of the population. But this issue with the conditional release date changing, which then, of course, changes. And what we see happen, and we've seen probably 8 or 10 just in the last probably 4 or 5 months, where the release date changed And either we have a designation date that is actually now after the release date, or they went from a typical 90-day, 120-day placement, because it was a shorter sentence, to having a 17-day placement or less. And, you know, we work pretty aggressively to bring it to people's attention, because the team has done the work. They're, as far as they're concerned, everything is done. The RRM has designated, the regional reentry folks have designated, they're done. Nobody's paying attention to the fact that the date has changed. The inmate is between teams.
Right.
A number of our case managers are running caseloads of, you know, 170, 180, 200, sometimes right. more if they're actually managing two caseloads. And so right. they're not paying attention to it. And meanwhile, here's yeah. this person who either has a halfway house date, like after he releases, so he's not getting a halfway house date at that point, or he's getting a halfway house date that is less than 30 days. Right. And, you know, everyone thought the 60-day cap was ridiculous, because what can you accomplish in 60 days?
Well, a lot.
You can accomplish even less in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So, in some cases, it was a simple reach out and it was fixed immediately. And in other cases, we've had to talk to everybody and their brother and right. sister.
It's one of those things where it'd be great if the new computation sheets had some of the projected dates or projected home confinement eligibility date that factored in possible earned First Step Act credit. And that way, and this is just me, but if I was seeing, okay, here's this date, here's this home confinement eligibility date, including First Step Act. Oh gosh, you know what? If I'm the case manager, I better get this person into an RRC placement before that home confinement eligibility date. Yeah, it's nice when people roll out to home confinement. However, it's kind of nice to get out of the institution sooner, I would think, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, I think it's moving in that direction.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked about it before, you know, there's been a lot of attention to the staffing issues in the Bureau, in the areas of correctional officers and case managers and nurses and things like that. But people don't think about, you know, those computer services people. You know, we talked about it, I think in last week's show, we mentioned it about, you know, you can't really convince a 22-year-old coming out of college that federal service is the way to go, because they have great benefits and matching TSP. They're looking at those high tech companies out there. They're not interested in the federal service. And, right. you know, the Bureau uses coders to develop. This is all internal coding, both the pattern, the time credit calculator, the conditional calculators, you know, the integration with the team and all of those kind of things. That's all internally developed. So.
Yep, it sure is. Any other classification?
I look at my list here so I wouldn't forget people. We've had some other issues happen. Some other lesser issues, some things that, you know, don't come up as much. We've had issues with pending charges not being clearly documented in the PSR. And again, those are going to create a problem. Another thing we've seen is the parole violations or possible parole violations. So you have this state charge in the back that you did your time for, and you know, you got released on parole, but then you kind of got caught up in some federal stuff. And the Bureau, unless it says otherwise, the Bureau will 100% presume that
it's an open case.
It's a detainer. It's more than just an open case. It's a detainer right. that it will be lodged and you will not be able to be released. And again, that bumps that scoring up. And getting that documentation in, we've done that for a couple of different clients where stuff happened. It wasn't an error in the PSR, but stuff was in process. And the documentation came in afterwards, after the designation. And of course, you know, you'd like to say we can send it to DSCC and they'll investigate it, but that's just not going to happen. So what we did was we made sure when those folks touched ground at that institution, that next morning they were getting, we were sending that documentation to facilitate the process. Because the normal process is an individual gets into the institution, and over that first 30 or so days, there's folks in the records office that are reviewing that PSR, their pre-sentence investigation report. They're reviewing the NCIC rap sheet, and they're looking for anything that looks open. And then they prepare what's called a detainer action letter and mail it out, and then they wait. And if we have the documents, we send them to them with all the right contact information. And then instead of having to just generically send out a request and just hope somebody gets it on their desk and takes the time to send a response back, we're sending those documents right to the institution. And so they're starting with the documents. So then it's just a matter of them reaching out, verifying that they're legitimate and true, and then the stuff's resolved.
Yep.
And we've had, again, we've had to do that more than one time. Most recently, we had a case that he had not yet been designated, and we were able to convince probation to send an updated memorandum. Which was, you know, the family was reaching out to the federal public defender and all these other places to try to get some movement. And again, going back to these other folks don't work for the Bureau. They don't understand custody classification. You know, the response from the federal public defender's office was, well, the judge isn't involved in designation, which is true. But the judge also can order that the PSR be amended to include this updated information.
Which would have an impact on the designation.
And the impact, which impacts the designation. And like I said, I was thrilled to see that, because I think that the designation he was looking at would have been very, very bad and would have created some safety issues for this person. So I know you were happy. I was doing a little happy dance here in my office.
And see, just knowing, having that knowledge, like round peg, round hole, like, no, this is going to be through probation then to the, you know, so the judge can amend and those and that. Because, you could have been calling this person or that person, you know, the family.
Well, and the other thing we did was we didn't just say do this. We offered alternatives. We need this or we need this. One or the other, because this is what's going to happen. This is the Bureau's process.
Right.
And, you know, kind of definitively explaining that unless probation provided something, not only was he going to get a higher secure facility, but we also articulated the reasons why that was going to be bad and why that was putting him in harm's way. And so I was... Like I said, I was doing a happy dance when the probation, because sometimes probation doesn't always respond as favorably. So again, they're looking at it like the case is done. I don't need to deal with this anymore.
Right. So it's very good that they were willing to get in there and make those changes and spend the extra time and do the right thing. So it's always,
absolutely.
It's always a good thing when that happens.
So I think we should shift gears to FSA because everybody talks about FSA. We talked a little bit about the conditional release dates, but the bigger issue with FSA is, for starting out, it's just eligibility. You know, we had a case that, and I think we briefly mentioned it, I think maybe a week or two ago, can't recall now. He was listed as, his offense, it was a conspiracy drug case. And of course, conspiracy is not ineligible. But the unit team was looking at the drugs involved the amount of drugs, and it was a fentanyl case, and they had him as ineligible, and it was no It wasn't. In that, you know, usually we would reach out to the institution. In that case, we were pushing up on when the time credits would be run. And we were also pushing up on, he had a lot of credit and was looking at an immediate release.
Okay.
So in that case, we actually reached out to central office to get some resolution on that because it was very time sensitive. And he got it corrected, got his credit posted with the posting and released about a week and a half later. Week and a half, 2 weeks. Very close.
What a country.
And that eligibility piece should be as clear cut and easy. We've talked about kind of the issues that you and I see with the offenses and the penalty charges and all
of
that.
I've been getting a lot of 922G all of a sudden, like, hey, I mean, that's, I don't know what's going on. What's going on with 922, that gun charge?
I don't know.
Are some case managers out there saying they got nothing coming, or they?
I don't know, because 922G has never been an issue. Now, there is one wrinkle, I will say, with 922G, and it's kind of weird, and from my perspective, but pattern was created outside the Bureau, so the Bureau like had no dog in the fight. Like they didn't get to give the input or give their opinion. It was all done externally. All firearms violations per the outside research folks, all firearms are considered violent offenses, which can impact pattern. But 922G uniquely is one of those ones that, you know, in training, it was 922 never violent, 924C always violent. And it was an all or nothing. And now we've got 922G that is FSA eligible, is nonviolent under VICLA, is nonviolent under prison litigation reform. Yet it's violent under pattern, which is weird. But like I said, pattern was not developed internally. So it can impact someone's points, but not their eligibility.
Right. So that was, but not their, yeah, their points, but not their eligibility for FSA. Good.
Right. Right. And it's just, like I said, it's problematic. So
yeah, another one I want to, I know this is on the fly totally. So if you want to take the fifth, go ahead. But we had a child abuse images in, you know, case, I guess that's child porn based anyway, but I guess there was one of the, because I know about enticement, not still being eligible, but there's this other one on that evidently.
So there are some, and I don't have it in front of me. I'd have to like do some research,
yeah, no,
but there are things that were missed in terms of sex offenses. One of them being the enticement. They went in and they listed specific penalty statutes. So, when you're looking at a statute, there is, you know, it's kind of like the old fashioned outlining. Like, I don't even think they teach outlining in school anymore. But when you and I were in school, because we're old, we learned how to outline. Well, statute is set up the same way. You know, it starts with the big number, and then there's subparagraphs. And under the subparagraphs, there may be upper and lowercase numbers and Roman numerals and everything else. And you've got to follow it down. So now you go to the FSA statute. And in Unlocking Federal Time Credits, in the appendix, we do provide a list of all of the statutes with their subparagraphs that are applicable, right? So if you're looking at a case and your plea was under a subparagraph, Roman numeral, you know, it's little b, 1A, capital A, lowercase, Roman numeral, II. But the law, the penalty statute, only refers to Roman numeral, III, right? And you were under 2Is, and this one says 3Is, you're okay. And it's a matter of looking at what the judgment says and what charge, what section of the statute were you specifically charged under. And it makes a difference. One little lowercase I makes the difference.
Look, I did not know that about that particular fence. I'd never seen an image case, be eligible.
Yeah. And so, I had to look it up when we were talking to that person. I had to go grab the book and open it up because.
So is this something that probably they're going to have to go all the way up to legal on this deal just to get the okay? You're right. It's actually eligible. Oh my God! There's this one.
They shouldn't, because the list is pretty concrete, confusing but concrete. But that's why when we're working with people, we talk about the importance of the administrative remedy process. Yes, we try to point out, and when we reach out, we provide pretty detailed emails. Right. We cite chapter and verse.
For sure. And yeah, you're right. If we're sending the email or emails plural, clearly talking about the statute, but wow, without that, just organically. Yeah,
because again, people look at it and they're like, oh,
no way.
That's
what they're going to be saying.
And it's kind of, we've been seeing that ever since the beginning. So even back when I was still working, things would happen. There'd be some high profile case and someone would get released with time credits and some U.S. attorney in a district would be unhappy that we just released this person with 365 days off early. And invariably, that U.S. attorney would call the U.S. attorney and the U.S. attorney would call the DAG and the DAG would call the Bureau. And eventually, several phone calls later, it would land in my lap. And I would have to pull up the judgment and commitment order, pull up the PSR, and then, do one of an email response, similar to what I do now,
yes,
right? Except what I was doing then was going, no, he's eligible, and would have to go in cite from the statute, cross-reference against the judgment and commitment order. And there was always this kind of passive-aggressive voice in my head going, yeah, you need to call your congressman because I got nothing to do with this. Right. But they were mad at the Bureau because they thought the Bureau, how could you possibly release this person? And some of the cases were egregious. Right. And it was, that just wasn't covered.
Right. There's probably some folks out there getting FSA credits that have done some pretty, stuff. They're receiving it. Yeah.
There's some high profile,
I know.
Individuals
I know.
Out
I know.
There.
And so
serving
gonna,
federal time for yep. things related to violating civil rights.
Ooh,
that are
go there,
time
huh?
credits.
Wow. Okay. I didn't think you'd get
because
that.
They missed that statute.
Right.
And that's why you and I have been advocating for, kind of relooking at that offensive penalty list. And, because there's also stuff on there that, And we hear people talk about 924C all the time. And it comes down to the fact that there just is no wiggle room. Congress said 924C is ineligible, period. And of course, I don't think a week goes by where somebody doesn't post about, I heard, and like, nope, it's not happening. And I've been accused of dashing people's hopes and dreams. And you and I work in the world of facts.
Something happened earlier today. I don't know if you saw it, but I think Cory Booker and somebody, there's a bill out for offenders that have served 10 years or 10. And it's a bill and it's just a discussion,
There is a whole lot. You would be surprised.
Yeah.
I was doing some research because, we had some rumors floating around and I was trying to kind of figure out, was there any meat to these rumors? And doing searches on bills introduced, and there are. I mean, people just don't realize the volume of bills that get introduced
right.
into Congress.
But the bill doesn't mean it's going to happen. That's the thing, y'all. Just because somebody submits a bill doesn't mean it's going to happen. Stuff with the Sentencing Commission,
Now, we did just post today, and it won't have impact necessarily on FSA, but it does have impact the 30th. The Sentencing Commission delivered to Congress their latest rounds of recommendations. And how it works with the Sentencing Commission is there's an implementation date, and in this case, it's November 1st of this year. And if Congress doesn't act, then they go into effect. Congress has to actually take affirmative steps to block a Sentencing Commission recommendation, or it becomes effective. And there's some stuff related to supervision, which is kind of interesting because in putting together a document for our followers, your followers, went through the 600 plus page document from the commission and took all of the synopsises and kind of put them into one document, making it a little bit more digestible. And I did that, excuse me. And so one of the things was having to do with supervision, supervised release, and how much and whether to impose it, and then termination, early termination. And the interesting part was, is they actually made reference to the Safer Supervision Act, which has been proposed and has gone nowhere. But we talked about the Safer Supervision Act in terms of comparing it to the long-term halfway house placements that are occurring under FSA. And while there's not a whole lot of research out there on recent research, I should say, on residential programs and what is that optimal time? You know, what's the sweet spot? There's nothing really recent. So it makes it difficult to say, well, 2 years in halfway house is bad. Well, we know anecdotally it's bad. And we know anecdotally, the longer you're under supervision, the more likely you are to get slipped up. But what has been studied, and that's why they have proposed the Safer Supervision Act, is they know the longer someone is on supervision, the more likely they are to get tripped up on something stupid. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they're wanting to kind of extend the discretion of the courts in how much they impose and for how long and if they impose it. And they are also looking at that early termination aspect. So the Sentencing Commission is tackling parts of it. And they referenced in their synopsis, the Safer Supervision Act. Now, oddly enough, if that is put into effect and individuals with low risk, low need, the courts decide, you know what, you can just do your time and be done, because they put the caveat, they wrote in the First Step Act that the credit that we talk about being applied to early release is actually applied to early transfer to supervised release. So if they pass the Safer Supervision Act with the intent of only giving those spending resources more efficiently, those high risk, high need people are the ones that need supervision, that need that more structure, versus the someone who's very low risk, very low needs. They screwed up. They just got to do their time and be done. But if the judge doesn't order supervised release because they don't need supervised release, they're not getting that time credit toward an earlier release date. They can only get time credit toward halfway house, which is another thing that needs to be addressed in the FSA law. We actually had a case just last month. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has to be last month. This is only the first week of May. That was just last month, where short sentence, no supervised release to follow. None of his credit was being applied to early release because he had no supervised release. It was all going to halfway house. And of course, on the worksheet, if you look at it at the top, when it says credit applied toward release? No. So they were like, well, you're not getting credit, and weren't. And I'm sure, again, novice case manager, you got to go all the way down to the bottom of the form at the top, go down 2-3 pages later at the very bottom. All of his credit was going toward, he had a conditional placement date. And bless his heart, the case manager was like, put him in for a date. Case the RRM gave him, Rantry gave him a date, which was 6 weeks after his placement date. And of course, we reached out to the institution, and that didn't go anywhere. And reached out to the region in that case, and that didn't go anywhere. We ended up reaching out to central office, and we got it taken care of. But in this particular case, and for those of you who either haven't been in the system, when it comes to administrative remedies at the BP9 level, that's the local level, right? It is the subject, the warden signs it, but it is those departments individually that are writing it up. So a case manager wrote up this administrative remedy that went through a unit manager, maybe the CMC, maybe not. I know some institutions, unless it specifically has to do with classification or something, they don't even send it through the CMC, which is a bad decision. Because many of our CMCs do have a better handle than our CMCs. They used to be my CMCs. They're not my CMCs anymore. But many of the CMCs have a much better handle on the FSA stuff as opposed to the case managers and the unit managers. But so they wrote this up. They sent it up to the warden. Warden signed it. And, of course, when they retained us, I was like, send us everything. And I'm like reading this BP9 response. I'm like, I can't even believe the warden put his name on this. And I felt bad for the warden because, like I said, some case manager who thought they understood it, wrote it up, went all the way up to the boss. Boss signed it. So we helped him with some language on a BP10 because we wanted him to preserve his administration.
And then legal's involved at that point, right?
Huh?
And then legal's involved.
Legal gets involved. But because, again, because it was such a tight timeline, we reached out to some central office contacts that we have to say, hey, the institution really got this wrong. They went and it got fixed before the BP10, the regional administrative remedy, was finalized. But our concern was, you know, And for those that don't know, the region has 30 days to respond. And the institution has 20 days to respond. And then when it goes up to central office, they have 40 days to respond. And they can get one extension. He didn't have that kind of time.
Nope.
So even though he was totally 100% in the right, and he actually wrote up his administrative remedy for the 9, pretty straightforward. He did, you know, sometimes we see administrative remedies that are all over the place. We encourage administrative remedies that are very tight and short and sweet and to the point. He did a pretty good job with it. But like I said, the institution came back with completely the wrong answer. And like I said, I felt bad for the warden because, you know, the wardens don't necessarily come from case management. Wardens come from any discipline, and they're relying on their departments and their subject matter experts to make sure that things are right. And that's why I always say, like, you got to go to the regional level at a minimum. You have to go to the regional level.
Because it gets another set of eyes,
two sets of eyes,
a more educated set of eyes, two sets of educated eyes. And so, you know, again, a case for us and our advocacy, you know, just having that knowledge base and then being able to elevate that quickly to the right people. Also, it's not just like some schmo's desk or some schmo's email account. You know what I mean? It gets to the right people.
Absolutely. And you know, the reality is, and we talk about this all the time, a case manager at any given time gonna have 30, 40 halfway house packets, maybe more. Sure. They're running a large caseload or they're managing two caseloads. Then you go to the regional reentry office, right? And we have 22 of them nationally. So at any given time, they're processing 100 or more halfway house packets coming from all different institutions. And the referral is not a live document. It's a PDF. So even if it was right in the moment, on the day it was sent, it was right. It's not now. And because of the volume and the pace, they're not going back into the live system and double checking everything.
Right.
And again, going back to the law, is this 10 versus 15 days.
Yep.
It creates problems, particularly when how quickly the date can change. For someone with, you know, a 12-month and a day sentence, a 13-month sentence, their date is changing. This assumes like no jail credit. Like they're walking in the door and they've got their good conduct time.
We got 4 minutes. 4 minutes. Go ahead.
Oh gosh, and you know it's what 118 days later they're getting 15 days. So it's just crazy. So.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, we talk about mixed. Do you want to do real quickly on mixed up PSRs or you want to just do something else?
Real quickly. I mean, we've talked about some of the mix ups we see in PRs with pending charges,
okay.
with GED and high school diploma. We have a case. We talked about it. Really an unusual one with immigration issue mix up. And again, somebody made a mistake. And nobody, not the probation office, didn't question it. Nobody questioned
it. The defense attorney?
Nobody did.
Man.
Nobody questioned the fact that the PSR said the person was both a citizen and a green card holder at the same time. Mm. And those are two mutually exclusive things. Nobody caught it. And we were not doing a PSR review in that case, right? And said, hey, I want to see the PSR before we do our little pre-admission orientation that we do. And I'm like, hold the fort. I'm like texting you, like, we got a problem.
Oh, man, all the King's Horse, it was all hands on deck.
Oh, my gosh.
Trying to
was
get
just
that.
One of those things. Like, as soon as I saw it, it, like, flew off the page at me. But that's, you know, that's what happens when you've probably read 10,000 PSRs in the course of your career. You know, you catch things really quickly. And,
So that you're right. That was a good catch, and it all got straightened out finally.
Yeah.
But man, if something like that happens and you're already in transit or whatever, it's kind of hard to get the toothpaste back in the tube, and that can certainly happen.
And I get it. Nobody wants to go back and do work on a case that they thought was done. And that's why it's so important to get things right from the jump.
Right.
And I will use that as a segue for you to plug our two books, one of them being on designation and custody classification. And while we wrote it's in two parts, and while the first half just goes through the scoring and individuals in custody can use that, absolutely 100%. But we really, really want to tailor that one toward attorneys understanding the PSR. And then the second one, you're throwing things. I saw that.
All right. And now?
And then second one is our unlocking federal time credits. Very good. And I know we're just about at the end, so I will very quickly say next week we will have a very big announcement. I'll just tease you.
Okay.
Won't tell you what, but we will have a very big announcement.
It's not Alcatraz, is it?
Not Alcatraz. I don't even.
We'll talk about that another time.
We'll talk about that another time. Yeah. I can't even imagine how much money it would take to bring that up to par.
I know, man.
It's been close since before I was born.
Not even going.
And I'm old.
Yep.
Right. But anyway, no, we have a big announcement next week.
Bye.
And you know, as always, please send us your questions. We love answering questions online and in real situations.
And our website, you know, federalprisonauthority.com, our Facebook group, First Step Act, or Early Release from Federal Prison, join the group. What else we have? The First Step Act YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
And our shows are also on LA Talk Radio that you can download. And so, you know, good stuff. And also, we're probably going to have some guests come on. By the way, I found somebody who wants to be a guest on in May, later part of May this month. So I'll talk to you about that as well. Yeah, it's a mental health treatment provider who has a federal contract. So we'll be able to talk about
services provided.
Services
so someone provides
post,
her in the halfway house?
Actually, it's pre-trial and post the whole thing. They do probation and BOP contracts. So it's
wonderful. That'll be really
spectrum.
Interesting.
Yeah. Alrighty then. Well, folks, thanks for coming out. Thanks for listening to Around the Block. We'll see you here next time on LA Talk Radio. Have a great week, everybody. Take care.
You take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.